Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
A look forward at 2010 today on Commodity Week. Welcome to Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. Later in this half hour, we'll talk with Michael Cordonnier of Soybean and Corn Advisor in Hinsdale, Illinois.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Our panelists today are Matt Bennett of Total Grain Marketing out of Windsor, Illinois, Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services from Oakland, Illinois, and Jackie Bakes of Stuart Peterson in Champaign, Illinois.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Let's open today's discussion with this question. The markets were too bearish at the bottom of the market last year. Remember, we're taking a look back. Is it possible they are too bullish at the top of the market right now? Paul Cooley.
Well, there's always that possibility, Todd. The big $100 question is, are we really going to see major shifts as far as acreage this coming year? And my opinion is that there'll be some increase in corn acres, but not as much as some of the private estimators are talking about. I think the other factor is we know the farmers have basically sold out of their commodities, and they're very conservative as far as trading the market's concerned. So I don't think the panic is going to take place as far as being on the wrong side of the market.
And Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson.
Well, I think I agree with Paul when it comes to the acreage shift. I'm not certain that we're going to see everything we do. I talked to one of our fellows that we talk to regularly down in New Orleans, and he was saying they felt that about 60% of the grain was out of the farmers' hands. That was lower than I thought it was, to be absolutely honest with you. So I think when you look forward, you have to really wonder if it's only 60% that's out of their hands, when's the rest going to come out? And what prices are going to take to get there?
And Matt Bennett, Total Grain Marketing.
Well, you know, when you're asking if we could maybe be a little too bullish here at the top, I guess the way I look at it from a producer's standpoint is, you know, I'm friendly to farmers' income because prices are phenomenal, and I feel like it's hard for me to get super bullish at these price levels. I'm not bearish by any means. But I do think the riskiest thing we can do in here with these sort of markets is do nothing.
What do you think, Matt, will be the primary things that will happen in the coming months to move the marketplace? And you can throw weather out of the mix because we all know about that one.
Well, I think, you know, obviously listening to Paul talk about acreage, I think, you know, the implications are big. I think whenever you look at fertilizer prices, certainly, you know, as long as commodity markets stay fairly strong, fertilizer prices are going to stay fairly strong. And I think it might inhibit some of the radical push towards corn acreage on maybe swing acres. The other things, of course, you know, we'll just have to see if this export market hangs in here. You know, some people are talking about inventory building, you know, with China on soybeans. And who knows, if they back out a little bit of their insatiable appetite for beans, you know, we might see a little bit of a back off, I guess, and you know, on our export demand. So who knows? I think there's a lot of things. If you'd asked me 2 months ago if we were going to have a $2 rally in corn, I would have told you I don't think so. So I don't know what's going to happen in the next 12 months, but I do know that the things that can shift it definitely are acreage and, you know, of course, weather.
On the soybean front, Paul, many have looked, as Matt suggested, at the export market. It seems the Chinese are insatiable. Will they stay in the marketplace much longer than they already have?
My opinion is that it's a very strong demand, and we also know that their livestock numbers seem to be good. their corn numbers from all crop scouts that we hear from said that they overestimated their production. My general impression is the best way to balance the equation is to continue to import soybeans in a big way. If that continues, our carryover is going to be close to 100 million bushels, and that's pretty tight in modern times. I think our other factor is I think that the farmer sales are closer to 80% sold for this crop.
Yeah, and so you suggested 60, but that came from New Orleans.
That's right.
Are you closer to Paul at 80 on your own?
I'm closer to Paul at 80 with the clients that we've talked with.
And what does that mean in February and March and April and July?
Well, I think that you can take a step back to the old adage. You know, if it's out of weak hands and it's in strong hands, you normally see a more solid and a higher trending market.
That's right. And the other factor is that any place in the world that people have to go to buy inventory, they're going to have to pay up because they can't go to the farmer for purchasing.
Does your elevator own that much?
Well, I think that I would agree with these guys. I don't think that the elevator owns quite as much as what a lot of people might think they do. Basis levels are pretty strong. I think origination is more of an issue than what anybody ever would have thought it was going to be 6 weeks ago. So, I think that farmers that are still holding on seem to be awfully tight holders. I guess that's one thing I would say that I've noticed.
Now, as a farmer, let's look forward to your crop year and not your marketing year, but your crop year. What are the things that most worry you at this point?
Well, a lot of things worry me, I guess. One of the biggest things, I just hope we learned our lesson the last time we were over $7 corn of not getting too aggressive on booking inputs without, selling some grain. And so whenever I look forward here, a lot of guys had a hard time in our neck of the woods getting the fertilizer on that they wanted to because it was so dry. A lot of guys weren't able to put anhydrous on when they wanted to. Corn on corn acres might be somewhat of a wild card. It just kind of depends on what the spring weather ends up like. So I guess I kind of hope we have a good freeze and thaw period for everyone that worked a lot of ground last year, because based upon the weather the last couple of years, we had boulders out there on people that did any deep tillage. So we need a good freeze thaw period, and then we need a real good spring to put, to be able to push the corn on corn acres.
Well, it'd be great for the government to finally get their report card as far as carryovers are concerned from the last debacles they've had as far as stocks reports are concerned next year. I think the real factor here is that the dollar is going to be important. It's also going to be extremely important to see how the legislation as far as ethanol and biodiesel is concerned. Our general impression is that the biggest mistake that the farmer should probably keep from doing is getting caught, in a big price swing. But all indications are that I think that this verdict of prices are still going to be very active as we go into the summer time frame.
Talk to me more about getting caught in a big price swing. If they're already 80% sold, how are they going to get caught? And are you talking about flat price and not simply being able to price a crop out because the margin calls will be so great on the marketplace and they'd have to carry themselves?
I'm not worried about the financial conditions of the major grain companies because I think it's A-plus to excellent. I think the major problem here is the actual bidding for acres process, will the farmers all, and the weather, will that encourage one thing? I think it's really out of the farmers' hands. As far as buying fertilizer and things like that, I think they're pretty sharp on that one right now.
Well, I think when you look, probably one of the biggest things is also the volatility that's in the market. As you look forward, I don't think the volatility is going away at all. And the ethanol issue, we just had a report of record ethanol production. The big question in my mind for the future is, will we continue to have ethanol subsidies? And we don't know that.
A quick note here. Congress, after we recorded this program on the 9th of December, did extend the ethanol subsidies for 1 year.
Because they're trying to take advantage of the subsidies that exist. So I think that farmers have to be very sensitive to what's going on at the government level. And the U.S. dollar itself is the wild card. What's going to happen with inflation? If I hear anything from farmers right now, it's a great deal of concern about two things. One is drought, and one is inflation, and whether the drought from the east is going to move into our area because of how dry we were this summer and how dry it's continued to be this whole fall.
Let's take up the ethanol issue just a little bit, because we're talking about numbers from the United States Department of Agriculture prior to the WASD report on the 10th day of December, because we recorded this on the 9th, at about, 350 million bushels over mandate level, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. So that's 350 million bushels that could come into the marketplace. Mandate would still be there if they were not to extend tax credits. The question is, do you think that would really happen with the price of crude oil bumping $90 continuously, and it looks like it's going to move higher, or does ethanol just compete well enough in the marketplace on its own? Does anybody have an idea, Paul?
Well, this is a very important question, and this is my opinion and not necessarily the Mr. ADM opinion. I think we have to be very optimistic that, you know, ethanol is a good deal for the Midwest and America. It's good. It's a good deal for the farmers. It's a good deal for a lot of employment and things like that. All indications I hear that it's going to be a passable deal, and we will get some help and stability out of Washington on it.
Well, and I think when you look at the scenario for ethanol, let's say versus 2008, we're in a very different export situation when it comes to DDGs. And DDGs are a significant portion of the profit at the ethanol companies. So when you say, can they stand on their own? Well, I think there's a possibility that they can. It certainly would be nice to see them continue to support them. But I think the DDG demand in itself, just coming out of China, and the idea that China's not paying any freight on it, really supports continued production at the ethanol level.
One of the things in Washington, D.C. that was in the proposal made by President Obama the week of the recording of this program, and things may have changed by this point, included the tax credits, the volumetric tax credit for ethanol, but also put back in the biodiesel tax credit as well. Does that make very much of a difference in the way you think about soybeans?
Oh, there's no question about that. When you look at that on the balance sheet, you know, the USDA hasn't removed the demand for biodiesel, the usage for biodiesel. And so I think if we see that come back in, we'll again see the biodiesel industry begin to pick up.
I would totally agree. And I think whenever you look at the ethanol, I mean, look at what Obama, I guess, threw at us with the extension of the tax cuts. You know, we're spreading the wealth around. Let's go ahead and keep it in the ag sector as well. And I think, you know, like Paul said, if you take away, you know, I guess some of the ethanol, you know, say you go down to maybe 31 cents, maybe. I've heard 36, or maybe stay the same. If you stay the same or don't support it as much, I'm just afraid that it would have a big impact on the Midwest. If, say, crude oil goes ahead and does drop $10, then it gets into a situation where profitability is a bit of an issue, and you could be pumping quite a bit of corn back into the pipeline if that comes to pass.
You want to talk about the price of farmland?
Yeah, it's amazing right now. I think, you know, anybody that's trying to buy a piece of farmland right now better have had a pretty good year, have someone good backing him, because you don't hear of too awful many sales that really are sound affordable, I guess.
And at these prices, are farmers just flush enough that they're going ahead and paying for the farmland up front and they really don't have to have that much backing?
That's my opinion. Yep. That it's cash deals, and the other factor is that it's farmer doing most of the buying. The 1031 isn't really there. There could be some trades across county lines. One of the things that we realize here is that there has been a tremendous amount of wealth created in the Midwest, and also we have to say too is that you know, the amount of corporation wealth as far as agri-grain companies and agribusiness, you know, John Deere, Caterpillar, and international Case IH. This has all been created to a large extent by this new ag support and stability.
Paul, do you want to make any predictions for the coming year?
Well, I guess my opinion is that I do think that we will have a very prosperous year in the agricultural society. And I think that there is going to be a tone set, and it's going to be more of a compromise situation as far as Washington's concerned, which is positive.
Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois, also along with us this afternoon. Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson, you have a prediction for the coming year?
Well, I think prosperous is a great word, and I think it's going to be a year that's going to be filled with opportunity and the opportunity to be able to take advantage of that and protect the wealth right alongside.
Matt Bennett is with Total Grain Marketing out of Windsor, Illinois.
Well, I've heard many farmers say they're not going to sell too much ahead of time this year because they got bid on it last year. And I agree with these guys, it's going to be a prosperous year, but I would look at what your profitability levels are, and if you're profitable at $5 corn out of the field for next fall, by golly, sell a little bit. I'd like to see us, I'd like to think that we're going to be able to rally throughout the year, but I think the levels that we're at right now offer a heck of an opportunity to make money, and so I'd like to see guys be able to sell throughout the year and just look for profitability prospects.
You're listening to our special Look Forward edition of Commodity Week. It was recorded on the 9th day of December of 2010. When we return, we'll talk with Michael Cordonier of Corn and Soybean Advisor. This is our special edition of Commodity Week, a look forward at 2011. Our panelists in studio include Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services of Oakland, Illinois, Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson out of Champaign, Illinois, and Matt Bennett of Total Grain Marketing from Windsor, Illinois. Our guest is Michael Cordonier of Corn and Soybean Advisor. It's a consulting firm specializing in fundamental analysis of soybean and corn production with special emphasis on South America. Mr. Cordonier, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
What is it that makes you and your company worth listening to as it pertains to Southern Hemisphere crops?
Well, we try to keep track of what's going on down in Brazil and Argentina. We travel frequently to the Southern Hemisphere. In fact, we spend most of the month of December in Brazil, especially out in Mato Grosso. So we go down and ground verify everything that we can for the corn and soybean crops in South America, because they don't have the field surveys like USDA does here in the United States. So I think you have to go down there and actually look to get a good handle of what's going on.
Michael, you're a very well-known market analyst and crop forecaster, and thanks for being on the show. Is the marketplace in early December here making a mistake on some of their observations or judgments about Brazil and Argentina and the acreage mix and the production potential?
Well, you always got to be careful. And I think the biggest concern is Argentina. You know, December is the main month for pre-pollination and pollination for the corn in Argentina. The La Nina is having an effect. They had a dry October, a drier November, and the forecast is continuing to be for a drier than normal December. You know, December is going to be make or break for the corn crop. And everybody's anticipating, you know, big exports out of Argentina. In fact, they've already, well, maybe they signed some contracts already with China for corn exports. But it's not in the bin yet. So you have to wait to the end of the month to make sure how pollination was and what your yield and what the yield forecast could be.
Michael, I'm gonna take a little bit of a step to the side, and I'm gonna ask you a twofold question. Can you give us an opinion on the attitude and the financial situation that the South American producer and the end user?
Well, the producers in Brazil, they like the prices, of course, but they don't like the strong currency. And the stronger the Brazilian currency, the less money they put in their pocket when they sell their products. And they don't like high interest rates. And Brazil has some of the highest interest rates in the world. So that's their two biggest concerns, along with, of course, high transportation cost and a lack of infrastructure. Now, in Argentina, there's one concern and one concern only, and that are the export taxes put in place by the government on all the commodities. The farmers just absolutely detest them. They got some farmers elected to the lower house in the Congress in Argentina, but it remains to be seen if they're going to be able to do any legislation to roll back some of those taxes.
Michael, whenever you look at the U.S. supply and demand balance sheet, and you know, obviously, we're in a fairly tight situation, which could become increasingly tighter if South America doesn't come up with a pretty good-sized soybean crop. Knowing what you know and seeing what you've seen, how would you approach this if you're a U.S. soybean farmer looking at, you know, pushing $12 fall beans for next year, you know, which seems like an awfully good sale, but, you know, how would you approach it? Would you maybe advise a guy straight up sales or, you know, buy some downside protection because you think the upside might run?
Well, I think it's going to go a little bit higher. You know, I have the South America soybean crop at about 6 million tons less than last year's production. Now, you are right on the money. We cannot afford a hiccup in anything, in corn, soybeans, cotton, wheat, sugar. Everything is really, really tight. And the market does not want to see a disappointing soybean crop out of South America. Now, it's going to depend on the weather, of course, but right now I got a lower crop than last year, and I think there's some downside risk here for the production, which would mean upside risk for the prices, of course.
Can you talk to us just a little bit about the physical attributes of farm in Argentina, how that varies maybe across the landscape there, and what the differences between it and the U.S. are? I think they may be not so many, and then contrast that with what's happening in Brazil.
Well, if you look at Argentina, in fact, if I would take you blindfolded Argentina and then took your blindfold off out in Santa Fe, you could not tell me if you're in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, or Santa Fe, Argentina. It looks the same. It smells the same. Same sort of crop rotation, corn and soybeans and sunflowers and alfalfa. The latitude is about the same. Their main production area is about the same latitude as about Kentucky or Tennessee. So, in fact, the same hybrids and varieties that work here work in Argentina as well. So the soils, the production practices, very, very similar. Now, Brazil is a different case, especially if you get up in Mato Grosso, the largest state. It's very tropical. They're only about 13 to 15 degrees south of the equator. It's a very hot and humid sort of growing condition. Take the hottest day you can see in Urbana-Champaign and then add on some more degrees and make it rain a couple times a day, and that's what it's like in Mato Grosso. So it's like a greenhouse. And under the right conditions, they have a very interesting cropping mix. Of course, we've all heard about the safrinha corn crop. Well, they plant soybeans first, and then as soon as they harvest the soybeans, they follow with a no-till planter and put corn in immediately, you know, the same day. So they can put two or three crops into the same field in 1 year. And if you get irrigation, which a limited number of farmers do, you can keep growing year-round because even though there's a dry season, the temperatures are very, very warm. You just lack, you know, natural rainfall. So irrigation can keep you going year-round.
Could you share with us your ideas and concepts about the final production in the U.S. as far as corn and soybeans are concerned? You know, will there be an adjustment in which way?
Well, you know, if you go down in September, October, November, usually you retract a little bit more in January. So I'm not expecting a big change in the USDA in the January summation, but if they do change, I think both might go down a little bit more, which, of course, has been a big surprise. After the good start we had last April, it certainly has sort of fallen off here at the end. So if there's going to be an adjustment, I think it'll be downward just a little bit more. Although with USDA the last couple of years, who knows about their numbers? They've been very volatile on their estimates.
Michael, when you know, we don't hear a whole lot about Asian bean rust, even though we know it still exists. When you look at the potential reduction in the bean crop, especially the potential for in Brazil and Mato Grosso, how big of an impact does Asian bean rust still have down there?
Okay, well, it came into Brazil in the year 2000, and probably the worst time was about 2002, 2003, when they lost about 5 million tons of soybeans for all of Brazil. Now, they've been getting better at controlling it. They've got the right fungicides now, better methods of application. And, in fact, Embrapa, the Brazilian research agency, has now released some soybean varieties that are tolerant to soybean rust. Now, they only have a one-gene tolerance. They have some other ones coming down the pipeline with two- and three-gene tolerances. So, eventually, they're going to be able to control it pretty good. But it costs Brazilian farmers, on the average, every year, about $2 billion in lost production and increased chemical costs. For a number of years, the farmers in Brazil applied, on the average, between 2 and 2.5 applications of fungicide. It's getting a little bit better now. Now they're down to about 1.8 to 1.9 applications of fungicide per field per year. So they're getting a little bit better, but it's cost them a lot of money over the last 10 years.
Michael, talking about corn and hearing what you had to say about the Argentina crop and then, you know, potentially shaving a little off the U.S. crop yet, it seems like it'd be a fairly friendly situation. I know a lot of farmers are itching to get some sales on the books, especially the guys that have all their inputs booked. I mean, they're looking at some excellent profitability levels. But given what we've already talked about, what kind of a strategy would you maybe employ to, you know, to leave the upside open for these guys?
Well, I think we're going to have a bidding war for acres. And it should be an exciting time between the first of the year and the March planting intentions report. And even after that report comes out, in fact, a lot of farmers are making decisions later in the planting season. They're waiting for that report to see what the USDA says and then sort of take the market response and do something with that. There's just not enough acres to go around. Wheat was our leader in the market back in the summer, and now it's kind of the leader here late in the fall. But any of these crops could be the leader. If South America has a disappointing soybean crop, then soybeans could be the leader, and then corn won't allow the corn to fall behind. So it's going to be a very dynamic period, and I would sort of keep the powder dry and wait for the opportunities.
Michael Cordonnier is with Corn and Soybean Advisor. He's based in Hinsdale, Illinois. Now a final word from our panelist in studio, Paul Cooley.
Well, it's always fun to have somebody of Michael's caliber here in the studio. I think it's important that smaller U.S. production in January.
Jackie Vakes.
Fireworks is probably the best description I've got for 2011 because I think we could see stronger fireworks than we saw in 2008.
And Matt Bennett.
I just want everyone to keep in mind that we have excellent opportunities right now. And, you know, nobody knows what's around the corner. And while I'm friendly to the market, I don't want to put all my eggs in one basket.
You've been listening to a special Look Forward edition of Commodity Week. You can always hear it again if you'd like on our website. The address is willag.org. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Hey, Michael? Yes?
Hey, one other question. You know, the people say that the USDA just dots whatever China says their crop size is. Do you think that they've overestimated their corn production, for example, over there from what your context
is? Well, I do think they've overestimated the Chinese corn crop. Okay. Most analysts have it about 8 to 10 million tons less than the Chinese estimates. And any time the Chinese officials come up with a statement, pretty much you can take the opposite of what's being true. And when they say they have a good corn crop and plenty and nothing to worry about, that means they're probably really worried about the corn crop. So, yes, I think they have overestimated the crop. And China has no transparency at all. So we just have to rely on the best information coming out of China. And I don't think the USDA has very good insight into China either.
Well, Michael, you know, taking it one step further, then what is your opinion as far as the information that comes out of South America?
South America, I think, is pretty good. In Brazil, CONAB, the supply company for the Brazilian government, all their people have been educated by the USDA. They try to mimic a lot what the USDA does. I'm pretty confident in what the CONAB comes up with. Now, in Argentina, I think there's a problem. I don't put much credit in what the Ministry of Agriculture says. They're always spinning it one way or the other. The best source, I think, in Argentina is the Grain Exchange of Buenos Aires. They come up with a weekly report, very well sort of detailed, and I think it's pretty good. So China's the worst. I think South America is okay, and I think Brazil's better than Argentina.
Michael, you know, it sounds like we're all fairly friendly to the market, and I think we've all got great reasons to be. My concern as, you know, a person that's in the grain business, but also a farmer, we farm some ground here in central Illinois. What would the impact be, given many of these things happen and we run corn to 7, 750, $8. I'm not saying it's going to do that. I'm just asking, what would the impact be, in your opinion, upon demand?
Well, I think it'd be terrible. You don't want $8 corn. High prices cure high prices. I think the farmers should be very satisfied. You know, $6.50 corn, they can still make plenty of money, and it's not at that exorbitant price that the whole world starts to complain about, you know, running out of food, and it's going to really cut back on your demand. That's what happened back, you know, a couple years ago. We got too high. We cut the demand terribly, and then the whole world went into a financial crisis, and we saw what happened after that. I do not expect that to happen again, but you never quite know. And one of the things I try to tell all my clients all the time is the weather in North and South America a lot of times is like a mirror image. Now, I don't know if the dryness in Argentina was foretold by dryness late in the fall here in the United States, or if the dryness in Argentina and southern Brazil will be a precursor to dryness in the United States. It's hard to say. But there's many, many times mirror images north and south of the equator. So if we have a hiccup in South America, then I would be concerned about maybe something similar happening in North America. I think the bottom line is we need record crops of all the commodities every year going forward. This is a demand market, which is the best there is. It's not like we're trying to, you know, cut the supply. So with China's demand keep going up, we just can't afford a hiccup in anything. And we already saw one hiccup in wheat. And if they do have a problem with soybeans, then, like they said, fireworks is the word for next year.
Did it worry you at all when China decided to raise interest rates?
You know, the Chinese talk down the market, and they do a really good job of it. They talk about interest rates and curbing speculation, and the market backs off terribly. And then what happens? They go out and they buy like crazy, you know, the next month. So the Chinese government, yeah, they want to try to slow things down a little bit, but food is an essential. And they can't not afford to be running out of food, to have high food prices. They want to be importing as much as necessary to keep that food price as stable as possible.
Michael, you're one of the foremost crop forecasters as far as yield and around the world. If you were investing several million dollars, where would you put it as far as...
Okay, I would not put it in Argentina.
Okay.
In fact, a lot of the big people in Argentina, the huge big conglomerates, they're moving out. They're increasing their production in northeastern Brazil. And in Brazil, that's where I would put it. I'd put it in Bahia, Maranhão, or Piauí, the sort of the northeastern part. But there's also a lot of investment going into sub-Saharan Africa, in Namibia, southern Africa. In fact, I was asked to participate in a program that's going to do 200,000 hectares of soybean production in Angola, Southwest Africa. Angola speaks Portuguese, so that's why they, you know...
Because you speak Portuguese, yes.
They wanted me to go there and do something with them, but I didn't have the time, or actually the time commitment was just way too much. But there is a lot of money sitting on the sidelines. Farmland is looked at as a good investment. Farmland in the United States is kind of expensive, so everybody's looking towards Brazil or Africa, and also Central Asia as well, the former Soviet Union. With the drought they had over there just this past summer, that kind of took a little bit of the steam out of that. But still, that's, you know, their prime breadbasket for the Eastern European area. So, and I do get, in fact, a lot of my clients are hedge funds, and I get this question all the time. They're looking for some place to put the money and they want to know where. My suggestion would be probably northeastern Brazil.
What state in the U.S. would you go for?
Ooh. I would go to the heart of the Corn Belt. I mean, I would go to central Illinois, central Iowa. You want to make sure you're going to have good return year after year, and I think you want to go for the highest production area. That'd be my guess. That'd be my recommendation. Yeah, the land's cheaper on the edges, but, you know, the production is, you know, marginal as well.
Michael, one of the questions that there were two things that I really wanted to ask. I want to take a step back to Matt's question about high corn prices. And when we talk about $7 and $8 corn, most cases we're talking about the futures, not the cash price.
Correct.
What is your, you know, what's your opinion as far as what cash price puts the top end on that market?
Well, I would be very surprised if we go above 7. I really would. But having said that, I've never traded one contract of soybeans or corn. I never have any position, anything. So I'm just looking as an outside observer. I think 7, you know, we saw this a couple years ago. You put $8 corn out there, and the farmers plant corn like crazy. Now, this year, we got other restrictions with cotton, needing acres and soybeans and that sort of thing. But I think any farmer should be very well satisfied with $6.50, $7 corn and not ask. You don't want eight. Eight's too much. It's going to, you know, kill the golden goose, so to speak.
Staying on this topic, Michael, I guess, you know, obviously in the U.S. we have production potential that we've never had. We could have a yield average in the U.S., you know, 175, I believe, if we had excellent weather. If we do get to these levels, say $6.50, $7, say a guy can sell, sell out in the futures and guarantee his 2012 production over $6, what level would it be that you might make multi-year sales?
Well, if you can get over $6, I think I would do at least part of my sales, you know, further out, and then I would make sure I bought the best hybrids I could and put on as much fertilizer as possible. And you're right. You know, we thought this past year was going to be the year when we really saw what these new genetic hybrids could do. It started out great, you know, more than 50% planted by the end of April, and everybody thought, okay, here's the year that we test the top end of the yields. Well, it didn't turn out that way. But I think if we do have one of these years, 175 is certainly within distance, certainly within distance.
And that's part of my what I've been encouraging my clients to think about is that, yeah, everyone's bulled up right now. We're coming off a couple of years where production wasn't what we thought it was maybe going to be. This year especially was a letdown. And I feel like if we push acreage, you know, 90-plus, and then tack a 175 on, we've got a fair amount of corn in the U.S.
Yes, you can solve your supply problem pretty quick with a very good growing season. But on the flip side of that, you know, the wheat's not very good and probably won't be very good next year either. At least we don't know yet, but it doesn't quite look that way. So there's not going to be much wheat to take over the corn's role. I think that we're going to be in a dynamic market here for 2 years. We can't solve our cotton problem in 1 year. We can usually solve a wheat problem in a year or so, but now a lot of the wheat areas around the world aren't doing so good. Soybeans and corn can solve their supply problem with a couple good growing seasons, but the first one up the bat here in South America, at least so far, it's not been very good for either corn or soybeans.
Michael,
so that's going to make it a little bit difficult.
What, you know, we hear all this flip about satellite imagery. What part of the growing season does it impress you? Does it just acres, head start on acreage, or are you very impressed with anything you're seeing there?
Well, I think the satellite stuff does good for acreage.
Yeah.
I also like to look at the satellites, you know, the greenness images. That's always nice and telling. You can see 1 year compared to the other year. But this year was a perfect example that you have to go out and look. And I went out at the end of July, early August, and did a tour through the Eastern Corn Belt, and I saw how small the ears were, especially in Indiana. And I put some pictures in my weekly report, which I never do, because one picture can skew the whole idea. But I thought, this is just so important, I just got to show these pictures. And then I showed pictures of these small ears in Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, and the phone just rang off the wall, said, where'd you get these pictures? I said, every place. That's what the corn looks like. And you don't see that in a satellite image, and you sure as hell don't see it in that weekly crop report, those condition reports of Monday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Once the corn gets reproductive, once there's an ear to see or beans inside the pod, those weekly reports just aren't very worthwhile. They give you a misleading, you know, impression of what's out there.
Michael, one of the things that we certainly are seeing here in the U.S., and I know is an issue in South America, is the demand on the infrastructure. You know, the more crop we grow, The more we have to handle it, the more real issues that there are. What are you seeing?
Well, I think the American farmers should thank their lucky stars. The infrastructure here is unbelievably good compared to Brazil. And I go to Brazil a lot. There is one road that comes out of Mato Grosso. Now, Mato Grosso is as big as the Midwest. It's six times bigger than Illinois. There is one two-lane road that goes in and out of that state. And I've been on that road 1,000 times, and the last time I was there just 2 weeks ago, it was trucks as far as you can see in both directions. And it's just excruciatingly slow, very frustrating. And the problem in Brazil is infrastructure just isn't in the Brazilian DNA. It's just not there. And when Brazilians come to the United States and I host them and I show them around the Midwest, their jaw drops at our infrastructure. But the Brazilian government just can't seem to get their act together. Now, there's one railroad comes into the southeast corner of Mato Grosso. It goes in about 50 miles or so. Now, they're building the second section as we speak, so it's going to go like another 150 miles inside the state. But they hadn't laid a 1 kilometer track for 8 years. And the farmers just, you know, clamoring to the government, you got to do something. You got to do infrastructure. But 8 years, nothing was done. So it's just a very, very slow and frustrating proposition.
I thought the Chinese had invested in that infrastructure, especially the railway. Did they stop putting money in?
Well, the Chinese are still haven't cashed a check, so to speak. They're still talking about it. In fact, the Chinese want to build a bullet train between Sao Paulo and Rio. Now, it's about 420 kilometers. It's all part of the World Cup and the Olympics going to Rio. But for all infrastructure in Brazil, I believe it after I see it. Because these things are on paper for 20, 30 years, and they never get off the drawing boards.
You know, thanks a million for spending so much time.
No problem. My pleasure.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
It's wonderful.
Okay, anytime, just give me a call.
Thank you. Great talking to you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay. Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye.
Okay, Todd, talk to you later.
Okay, now bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Hey, Michael. Oh, he's gone. Sorry.